Local journalism is one of the keystones of American democracy. There's no substitute for an experienced local reporter, not just to get a story, but to share it with the insight and perspective that only comes from living in the community in which they report. Today's guest is one of 13 fellows with Report for America, a new effort to put reporters on the ground in communities across America. She's Alexandra Watts this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter. To do that, we sit down every week with the best storytellers around, filmmakers, authors, journalists, and more, to make sense of the big stories that shape public life in the United States today. To help us this week, we're joined by Alexandra Watts, a reporter with Mississippi Public Broadcasting, who's also one of 13 fellows at Report for America, an innovative nonprofit organization that is putting local reporters on the ground across America. Alexandra, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. First time in Rhode Island, but beautiful state.
Well, welcome. We're thrilled to have you here. So, you know, you've got this interesting biography. You went to Arizona State University, the Cronkite School. You have been working as a journalist for some time, but I'm curious, where did you get the journalism bug?
Oh, wow. So I've lived in Arizona my whole life. So that's where I went to school, both high school and college. Everything was there, first jury duty summons, everything in Arizona. It probably started for me in high school. I took an AP English course, and in that class, the focus was on nonfiction writing. And I had this really amazing teacher who made a comment on one of my papers that said, you know, this is like magazine style writing. And from there, I was like, you know, I like writing, you know, maybe I could do it for a career. And even though I'm in public media now, public broadcasting, that really started the journalism bug for me.
And what is it about journalism, though, that keeps you grounded in it? So, like, it's one thing to get sort of that affirmation, but to sort of commit to it as a career, it has to be something else.
There are just so many stories to be told. I mean, even in Arizona, you can never run out of stories, and there are 49 other states outside of Arizona and the whole world. So just being able to tell other people's stories and then being able to be creative with it, especially with radio, bringing in sounds and things like that.
Did you come from a family that read newspapers or followed news on TV or the radio? I mean, sort of a story, for lack of a better term, a storytelling or story appreciating family?
I did, yes. I have no other journalists in my family, but, you know, newspapers were always around. NPR, PBS was always on. I remember one of the first magazine subscriptions we got was to Rolling Stone magazine, which kind of ignited a love for pop culture for me. So always been surrounded.
So when you were at Arizona State, you were the first ever audio and podcast editor for the State Press, which is Arizona State's independently run student newspaper. Tell us about that. I mean, that sounds like a pretty big deal.
That was, oh man, I can't believe that was probably around 3 years ago. They were just advertising it online. I had never worked for the State Press before. I did not know I was going to be the first one ever. I applied, just kind of went in there. I worked with a really amazing team of student journalists there, and we just built it up, and it's still going today, so.
Did you have experience with audio editing? I mean, sound editing, I can speak from personal experience, is very difficult to do well.
I did have the experience, but I think being thrown into a position like that, especially having to build this foundation and start from scratch, that's an education within itself.
What were the kinds of stories you were telling back then with the state?
So they were all related to life for Arizona State University. So we did everything from student government to Arizona State University history. So it was a wide range of topics.
So, you know, there's so much different journalism out there, and you said that you first got the journalism bug for something that you had written. Why broadcast journalism as opposed to print journalism?
When I first started J school, I really didn't know where I wanted to go. I didn't know if I wanted to do print digital or broadcast. I think I got into podcasting first, just kind of with another student club, just kind of as a little side thing. Really enjoyed it. Also really enjoyed NPR and public media. So they just kind of all met together, and that's how I'm here today.
So tell us about Report for America. It first came to our large attention when we had Charlie Sennett of the Ground Truth Project on this show. Great guest, and the Ground Truth Project is a wonderful project.
Yeah.
And so this is sort of a division of that. Tell us about that, because some of our audience members may not know what Report for America is.
So Report for America is a program, and right now there are 13 of us. And we are sent to newsrooms around the country to report on specific issues. I'm in the Mississippi Delta. We have two other core members, that's what they call us, in Mississippi and all over the country. And we go to newspapers, public radio stations, basically everywhere, and report on underreported issues.
Such as?
So criminal justice is one, health is another. In the Mississippi Delta, mine's kind of wide-ranging, but with a focus on poverty.
So these are sort of local perspectives.
Yes, really, yes. And right. That's the thing. This is not, it's a national program, but the focus is on local news. So whether you're in the Mississippi Delta or if you're in Chicago, you're focusing on local storytelling.
So you're in the Mississippi Delta now.
Yes.
What, for Americans and our audience who have not ever been, what do they need to know about that part of the country?
Oh, wow. Well, prior to this, I had never been to Mississippi either, and not the Mississippi Delta. I would say one thing is that there are a lot of ways that people view Mississippi as a whole, and a lot of that does have to do with the state's history. And I feel like there's a lot of focus on that. And yes, those things happened, and no one's denying it, but you know, there are other things that are happening in Mississippi. You know, the Mississippi Delta is a region and it has local communities just like any other city or area in the United States. So there always tends to be a focus on Mississippi's past, which is completely understandable, but having that past color everything from coverage to your perception about it, I think you can get a view that's not always there.
So that past really, primarily is a history, not primarily, but partly at least, a history of slavery. That's really what we're talking about here. Is that not correct?
Slavery, civil rights, things like that. Definitely, I think with the civil rights, you know, Emmett Till was there. That's where the case happened and where he was murdered. So I think when you think of the Mississippi Delta for a lot of people, you do think of those events.
And so you think for some people, and I think it's true, that's really the only perception they have of the Mississippi Delta, not knowing much beyond that history, which was not a very proud history, to say the very least.
I think that, and I think the poverty aspect goes along with that. A lot of the counties in the Delta do fall below a certain income level, and poverty is an issue that I report on too, but I'm not just reporting on poverty, but how that intersects with everything from education to healthcare to anything. Yeah.
Well, and one of the things that I listened to some of your reporting, particularly about charter schools, and you know, Mississippi continues to lag behind most of the nation on educational achievement. And I think that for people outside of the state, there's a perception, and I'm wondering if this is right or wrong, that a lot of this has to do with social justice. A lot of this has to do with the legacy of slavery and the legacy of Jim Crow. Is that fair, or are there other forces at play that are affecting educational attainment in the state?
I think there are definitely other forces, and I think when looking at Mississippi, you know, the Delta's different from other regions and areas in the state, but even within the Mississippi Delta, there are about 18 counties, and those 18 counties differ as well.
How large an area geographically is the Delta? Again, for people who might not be familiar with the state.
It would be the northern part of Mississippi, kind of down to the central. So it's about 18 counties. Mississippi has over 80 counties. Maybe a little less than a quarter of the state.
Okay, so if you were to drive from one end to the other, let's say north-south, how long would that drive take, just roughly?
So from Tunica to Greenville, where I live, that's about 2 hours. And then from Greenville down to Vicksburg, which kind of ends it, about an hour, hour and a half. I would say if you want to take a tour of the Delta, just going straight down, give yourself 4 to 5 hours, I would say.
So it's a large area. I mean, we're not talking about some little pocket. How many people live there, do you know?
I'm not completely sure. I think it's a little under 500,000.
Okay, so it's a substantial population of people, too. And what is the sort of the racial composition of the Delta? Is it primarily African American, or?
As a whole, it's predominantly African American. In certain counties, that may not be the case, but if you're looking at all 18, yes.
So how did you wind up there? I know Report for America, but how did you have a choice about where you could go, or was it no, you're going to go to Mississippi?
So when I applied for the program, there was this station and another public media station that was there. I kind of knew from the beginning that I wanted to go to Mississippi even before I applied.
Why?
I don't know, and I asked myself that too. It's just something about it. I had never been to Mississippi. But I just felt like reading the description at first, like, I want to go here. I want to end up here. And because of my skill set or where I have experience and where I'm trained in audio, it just kind of seemed like a fit.
So this wasn't because you had family roots there.
No.
This was an interest in that area.
Yes. I have family in the South. My father's from North Carolina. And I'm hearing that we do have some family roots in Mississippi. I don't really know where. That's another thing. But no, my first time there. And I really, really like arts and culture, especially music. So the culture of the Mississippi Delta also really attracted me to the area.
So you arrived there having never been there about a year ago, roughly, by the time this broadcast. What were your first days like? I mean, you're from Phoenix, Arizona, which is a cosmopolitan area, you know, very different than the Delta in terms of numbers of people. And all, what was it like? You fly in, or I assume maybe you drove in. However you got there, there you are, boom. What was it like?
So I flew in with my mother at first, and when we were first going over it, it was just so green coming into the South, and I am not used to that from Phoenix, Arizona.
No kidding.
But I spent the first week in Jackson, where my station is. So Mississippi Public Broadcasting is located in the Ridgeland, Jackson area. I live 2 hours away in the Delta in Greenville, Mississippi. But my first drive through the Delta, it was definitely different, but I didn't have any bad feelings going into it. And even being there now, you know, I am used to a larger city. You know, I don't feel bored. I really do love where I live.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard 4 times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a remarkable crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. On most days, you can find me running the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. And if you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can do so at JM Lutis. Joining me, as he does every week, is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller, who is the author of 17 books and is also an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal. You can find Wayne on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller, all one word. And our guest this week is Alexandra Watts, a talented young reporter with Mississippi Public Broadcasting and a fellow with Report for America. You can find her on Twitter, too, at Alexandra Watts, AlexandraWatts. So in the year that you've been there, are there any stories that have stuck with you?
There are definitely stories that have stuck with me. Probably a few. One of them would be covering the Emmett Till trial when it was announced about a year ago when this airs that it had been reopened.
And so for folks who may not know who Emmett Till was, just give us that brief history.
Emmett Till was from Chicago, and in the 1950s he came to visit family in Mississippi, where he was murdered. And this kind of ignited a part of the civil rights movement, because when his body was flown back to Chicago, his mother wanted the casket open, and it showed a lot of people the horrors of what was really happening.
The brutality.
The brutality, yeah. Especially to a young teenage boy.
Yeah. And that case was reopened when you were there, is that correct?
It's been reopened actually for a while, but it was announced this summer. So I went down to the courthouse actually, where the case was heard in the 1950s. And that was really powerful, because one of the first things I had heard about the Delta was about the Emmett Till case way back then. So that was probably one of the first stories that I did as well. But just being able to be there, and I talked to his cousin who was there the night that Till was kidnapped before he was murdered, and that was very powerful for me to be able to experience that history.
What has that story meant to the people of Mississippi?
I think like I said before, when you go back and you're talking about Mississippi, a lot of people do have a perception of it that comes from its civil rights history. But there are changes that are being made today. And one thing that kind of stuck with me was I'm in this courthouse, and most of the journalists there are journalists of color. And that just would not be the case back when this
The 1950s when, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It would have been a white press corps.
Oh, yes.
Essentially.
Yes. And I think with that, you're not hearing all of the voices. I know some people like to say, oh, we're giving a voice to the voiceless. I don't necessarily agree with that. I think whether you are in the Mississippi Delta or Phoenix, Arizona, you have a voice. I think it just depends on what kind of news coverage you have, how often that voice is heard. So everyone in all of the regions that we're reporting on, they've had a voice. It's just our job with our respective newsrooms to really get those voices out there and amplify them. So even though, you know, the Emmett Till case took place over 60 years ago, making sure that in the future, all of those voices from every county, especially African-American voices, are heard in press coverage.
So that was a very high-profile case.
Yes.
There's no question about that. And that was sort of your beginning days down in the Delta. But after that, a lot of your reporting has not been high-profile cases. It's been people who live there.
Yeah.
So we always like to talk about craft on the show. And so here you are, this young graduate from Arizona who has written for and done work, audio and podcasting for independently run student newspaper. Here you are. How do you introduce yourselves to people? What was that like, just approaching people and?
It was a lot of just talking to people, making phone calls to like different nonprofits or agencies, and just kind of explaining myself, saying where I'm coming from, where I work for. But everyone's been really receptive, really kind to me. No problems there. So I haven't felt like an outsider, if that makes sense.
I laugh because the joke in Rhode Island is you could live here 40 years and you're still an outsider.
Right? or 100 years.
Well, yeah, exactly. So, you know, one of the issues that I think you've done some reporting on is issues of food insecurity. How does that play out in Mississippi?
Well, the Delta, if you're taking those 18 counties, is one of the most food insecure regions in the country. And I mean, it's there, you can always report like the statistics that this area is food insecure. But with my reporting, one of the recent stories that I worked on was how the flooding affects that. A lot of people are losing access to their homes, and that means there's more of a need for food banks and things like that. And some of the food banks are starting to run out of food, and you're seeing lower amounts that they're able to supply to the public. So not just reporting, you know, this is a food insecure region, which is true, but how that really affects the daily lives of people in different counties.
Is it just the flooding, or are there other socioeconomic factors at play here?
Other socioeconomic factors at play. So to clarify, the flooding didn't just cause this region to be food insecure. But when you have an event like that, yeah. for some regions that don't have the resources, it can make things worse.
What are some of those other factors, though, that are contributing to it?
I would say poverty is definitely one. That would probably be one of the major ones, I would say.
I have this, this hazy historical memory of Bobby Kennedy traveling to Mississippi when he was a
he did
1966.
Yeah,
and powerful images and powerful stories about things like poverty and racial injustice and food insecurity 50 plus years ago.
Yeah,
how come there hasn't been more progress?
I don't know. That's part of my job too, is to go around to different people and ask them, you know, what it's like for them. You know, I'm new to the Mississippi Delta, can't really speak on behalf of them as someone who doesn't live there. So that's part of my job, is just going and talking to them and really.
So you put a human face on statistics and data. You were saying that earlier. And just, how, again, craft-wise, what does that entail? You meet someone and you listen, correct? With a tape recorder running, and how do you draw people out, or do you even have to draw people out? Are they willing to share their stories? I mean, we have storytellers of all kinds on here, and different people use different methodologies and so forth and so on. But how do you work that?
It honestly depends. Some sources I get just through cold Facebook messaging, talking to somebody about who
Facebook.
I am.
Here we go.
Yeah.
I knew Facebook was going to come into this.
Some people I just meet. I like to travel around the Delta a lot, too, because there are so many blues sites to see. So sometimes you just meet people by chance. So that really just depends on the story. But I would say the constant for me is I like it like it's a conversation. So I may have my big earphones on and a microphone in somebody's face, constantly checking levels, but making them feel comfortable too. My stories are usually around 5 minutes to 5 minutes, 30 seconds, but conversations I have with people sometimes can last about an hour. So really sitting there and listening.
I think it's so important in reporting of whatever kind, getting out into the real world as opposed to staying in your newsroom and making phone calls. Certainly some of that is really important. But I know from experience and reading that the best reporting is when you leave your desk, you go out, and it sounds like you do that all the time.
So put the local reporting you're doing in sort of a national context. We sort of have an interesting moment in America's public life right now, where so much of the media coverage is squeezed by what's happening in Washington. Talk to us from your perspective about the continuing importance of local stories.
Well, I think local journalism is and always will be important. I grew up in Phoenix, so that means I had a public radio station to choose from, a public television station, multiple newspapers. And I guess I was really spoiled and kind of lucky with all of the news I was able to consume about my daily life. And I think I kind of took it for granted, you know, just things that I would find. I can just open up a newspaper, go online and see it. A lot of communities across the United States do not have that privilege, and that's not fair. And I think a lot of people do, if you do want to make a change right now, I think the start is being informed, and I think that starts locally as well.
So on the Report for America page, there's an interview with you, and you already talked about giving voice to the voiceless, and in fact, it's listening to people who have a voice, which I thought was a wonderful quote. And by the way, we're going to steal it.
Absolutely.
Just so
we're
you know.
We're shameless that way.
Sadly, we are shameless that way. But there's another quote, and I'm going to read it because I love this too. Quote, future generations are going to have so many questions for us and what we were doing. There are so many ways to give back and take action, and my way is by informing communities. Talk a little bit about that. I mean, that's a principle.
Oh, thank you.
That's a good thing. That's what newspapering and journalism and broadcasting should be about.
Well, I have a huge interest in the 1960s, whether that's music or culture or history. And whenever I speak with somebody who lived in the 1960s, I'm always asking questions about what it was really like, because that was such a time for change. I feel like right now, this is going to be the 1960s for a future generation. They're going to have so many questions for us about where were you when this happened? How are people doing this? So my thing is, I want to do something. And so by storytelling and working in journalism, being able to give a voice to everybody. I think one thing with the 1960s is sometimes you hear the same perspective of things that happen, and sometimes you do not hear from everybody. So my role in local communities, if we really want to get a more solid, accurate picture of what 2018, 2019 is going to look like in the future, we have to talk to everybody.
You know, one of the things that worries me about public life in general is that there's a whole generation of kids who only get their information from their social media. And I'm curious if you have thoughts about how do you reach those younger audiences, maybe kids who are just first becoming aware of the world around them, through sort of, you know, traditional established media, whether it's public media or print journalism or what have you. Do you have thoughts about how you reach students like that?
I think meeting them where they are, so whether that's an Instagram page or Twitter or whatever the youth are really into these days, I think meeting them where they are instead of maybe, I don't want to say forcing them, but just maybe assuming that they're automatically going to come. But I think once you have that foundation, then I think they're more apt and more likely to really seek out news and to go to these more traditional outlets, tune into their public media stations, read from a newspaper, things
so
like that.
So we've got a minute left. Okay. And I'm curious if, you know, if thinking about your experience with the teacher who gave you that encouragement that made all the difference in your career, what advice would you have for a like-minded student now thinking about maybe I want a career in journalism?
Oh, wow. I would say, honestly, just go for it. Just follow your passion. Before I majored in journalism, I thought I was going to go do something in the medical field because I thought, you know, that's what I'm supposed to do. And I always had this passion for writing and telling stories, and it led me here. But if I would have ignored that, you know, encouragement and just kind of gone down a different path, I wouldn't be here. So, you know, if you like to do creative writing, nonfiction writing, there are things that you can do with it. And once you get that writer's bug, you know, just let it infect you. Let that bite infect you.
That's beautiful. Well, your storytelling is phenomenal, and we're thrilled
Thank
that you're
you.
Able to join us today. She's Alexandra Watts from Mississippi Public Broadcasting. That is all the time we have this week. But if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter or visit pellcenter.org, where you can always catch up on previous episodes. He's G. Wayne Miller. I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.